everyone, Justin Chisholm here, welcoming you once again to another edition of the Yacht Racing Podcast Extra. My guest this time is Leon Sefton. That's a name that may not immediately be familiar to you, but let me explain that Leon is the man behind the amazing TV coverage we all enjoyed at the 36th America's Cup down in New Zealand. Leon headed up a production team of almost 80 people during the Cup, but as you'll hear in the interview, his work to make the coverage of the 36th America's Cup the very best ever actually began several years earlier. Leon Sefton, welcome to the Yacht Racing Podcast. Thanks for getting up early down in New Zealand. It's late at night here in Europe. You must be a little exhausted after your stint with the America's Cup. How are you feeling right now?
Oh, I mean, the America's Cup's the kind of thing you have to give everything to every day. So, yeah, you certainly do throw yourself at it and come out of the end of it, and you need to kind of feel like you've left it all on the park. And I think, yeah, as a group, we did this time. So it's feeling really satisfied and really proud of what the team achieved.
So your role, as I described in the intro, your role is on the TV production side of it, the live show that we all enjoyed from around the world. I want to get into the nitty-gritty of that, but you're a Kiwi, you're an Aucklander, I think. The Hauraki Gulf is where you grew up. How special was it to have the event there and to be working on showcasing your country and your hometown?
Oh, that's a... It's a really nice question. It was amazing to have the America's Cup here in Aotearoa. I watched the America's Cup in 2000, 2003 when it was down here. Back in those days, I was a young TV director and got to kind of work on a few races courtesy of Dennis Harvey, who was producing, and kind of gave me a bit of an intro and a step into it. And one of the hallmarks of an America's Cup down here is the waterborne public interest and the landborne too. And so, you know, to come to, pretty much a post or a recovering COVID environment where New Zealand, Auckland was able to operate and to just put this event on was pretty extraordinary. And, Grant Dalton had a vision, which was to bring the racing in close, make it accessible to every New Zealander to view, whether it's on a boat, if they have one or had access to one, or on land. And it was really extraordinary. You know, I've had the privilege of working on quite a few big sailing regattas, such as Volvo Ocean Races and Cups in the past. And you get used to seeing a lot of spectatorship. But something I think that New Zealand was determined to demonstrate was that, you know, we can really throw our weight behind a big event such as this. It was a bit like having, if you're into your rugby, and an analogy would be Eden Park. It was pretty much Eden Park on the water. Amazing.
And the atmosphere must have been amazing. I mean, it looked great to all of us. You know, many of us were in lockdown while it was on, so we were living vicariously through you guys. On a day-to-day basis, I'm guessing you were working some pretty long days, but could you soak up a bit of the atmosphere?
Yeah, we were stoked to be able to generate the coverage of the racing for the international audience. We were really conscious that there were a lot of people who were doing it a lot tougher than we were currently. You know, we skirted with some COVID scares, and we were prepared for that in terms of how we set things up for the event so we could continue to operate. So every day we went on air, you know, I was lucky enough to have colleagues here from overseas, such as Shirley Robertson and Ken Reed, and, you know, they were working constantly, talking to colleagues and family back home who were, you know, under much stricter kind of COVID situations than we were, and they were working and they were blown away. So they were a really good canary in the coal miner in a way to have there with us in the room every day, reminding us that, gee, there's people hanging on the edge of their seats. There's very little going on globally with live sports. And so we knew we had to put our best foot forward, and it was a really good motivator to have every day that, you know, let's put our very best show on, let's work as hard as we can so that, you know, people out there who are doing it pretty tough have something to wake up for and be excited about.
And the atmosphere now, the Cup's kind of, the circus has ended. The teams in the main have disappeared, although I think there's probably still a few people knocking around the team bases. Is there still a bit of a buzz around the race village down there?
It is really like the circus tents have folded, you know, and it's moved on to the next town. It's what it's like with a cup is pretty much the show ends, and that's all she wrote, folks. And you can kind of hear the echoes of the trophy presentations around the viaduct there. I mean, the team bases are pretty much wrapped up. There's some the team ribs and some of the AC75 race yachts are wrapped and on the wharf ready to be shipped home. And so it does feel like, you know, we're in a bit of a take a deep breath phase whilst the next chapter is designed, and then we all kind of turn our attention to AC37.
So you've taken a little break, I know, just a few days, because we've been trying to set this podcast up for a week or so now. Well deserved, I'm sure. But you're still working. You still got debriefs to do, analysis to do. What sort of stuff have you been up to since the cup finished?
Well, the biggest thing is writing event reports and doing some exploration on the audience figures internationally. You know, we had a lot of goals, which was to at least match the very high standards of Bermuda and San Francisco AC34s and 35. You know, and so we will have the final figures in hand in a few weeks, and then we'll find out how we've gone on the way we set things up. You know, just a reminder, you know, from a television standpoint, the idea was to make sure that it was free to air internationally wherever possible, so that the coverage wasn't hidden behind paywalls wherever possible, and audiences who wanted to engage could easily access the coverage. So that was our stance, and our ambition was to broaden the reach of the event, try to get beyond the hardcore America's Cup viewer and into more of a casual sports and more of a general sports or just general enthusiast audience. Here in New Zealand, you're preaching to the converted, like an All Blacks rugby test match, everybody watches it. And so I think we can probably say that we'll have really strong numbers here. I'd expect we'd have very strong numbers in Italy. You know, the Luna Rossa fans were extremely engaged, which was just amazing. Top effort by that team. So, yeah, the next few weeks will kind of reveal how we've gone.
Yeah, we were pretty lucky with the teams in the end, weren't there? People complained there weren't enough of them, but what we had was high-quality teams and also really passionate fans from every country. The Brits are super patriotic. The Italians, we know, are super passionate about everything they get involved in that's got the national flag on it, and particularly that whole Luna Rossa brand is very strong as well. And the Americans too, and then obviously the hometown heroes, the Kiwis. Did that make it kind of your job a little bit easier because the story was kind of telling itself?
Yeah, it's a good question. We had an extraordinary America's Cup story this time. You know, been lucky enough to be around the Cup for some time. You know, my first big regatta was 2007 Valencia, where there were a lot of teams. I think the comment I'd make is probably one of the key features of this America's Cup is, as you say, every team that was there were very high quality, extremely well organized, well funded, really high level of detail being paid attention to. The racing was a really high level. And so I think in a way people were surprised. It's like, wow, geez, you think particularly in the first iteration of a new class, you could forgive particularly the challengers who, you know, weren't directly involved in designing the class and the protocol might be behind a step. But actually, we had some extraordinary racing, and my hat really goes off to all the teams that took part because they all had their day and demonstrated that they, you know, they were really forces to be reckoned with and, you know, top examples of professional sailing teams.
So, Leon, what's the best way of describing your role in the TV production here? I want to say that you were the boss of the whole thing. I think that's probably fair to say. But tell us in your own words. Well, tell us your title, first of all, and then give us the job description.
So my title was head of production for America's Cup Television. I was second on board, brought along by Steve Nuttall from the UK, and Steve ran the television project. Steve's got a really broad, interesting professional background, and he spearheaded not only finding the production partner and working alongside me and bringing a lot of other people into the project, He also spearheaded the rights and distribution project. So it was, you know, pretty much getting America's Cup out to the world to view, handling all the contracting, and that was quite a few years' work to set that all of that up. So my role was assisting in the decisions on how to generate the production, and then rather than just stand back and let it happen around me, I took a role producing the production day to day as well. So in the gallery where we've got all the incoming camera and audio feeds, and putting the show together. So that's the bit I really love. That's the bit where we get to work with the camera operators and director and the commentators, all the technical team, of which is about 75, to shape the show. And that's a day-to-day effort to improve it every single day. You have a vision and an idea of what you want to achieve, and America's Cup is a pretty complicated, complex production to put to air. Unlike a lot of other sports, which are stadium-based, all of our camera feeds are coming in by RF. And so that can be technically very challenging, particularly in an environment such as Auckland, where we have, you know, five racecourse areas and some pretty big distances involved in bringing those signals in. So there's a lot of lead-up work to making all that happen. And then the regatta itself is, you know, really, okay, what new angles, what new treatments, what new ideas can we put on the table for viewers today?
I want to talk about the new stuff, but I also want to just pick up on that idea. You mentioned stadium. We hear about stadium sailing a lot these days in the Olympics and ocean race, import races and Sail GP. But it isn't a stadium, is it? It's nothing like a stadium. It's a big open stretch of water that you guys make look like a stadium. Just talk a bit about the challenges that are involved in all of that. You talk about the RF feeds. You can't run a cable back to your studio. You've got to bring everything in over the airwaves. That's one problem. But just the whole logistics is a nightmare, isn't it?
The logistics are really big. The first thing is, you know, the priority is run the racing. And so Iktimi of Dunedin developed and designed their race management system. Everything's done digitally, which was a breakthrough that was achieved with San Francisco and followed up in Bermuda. And so Ian Murray, the race director, he has to be able to run a race. And so for that, we established a mesh, meaning that we could push and pull signals to and from the race yachts from the water so that we could place marks accurately so that Ian can communicate with the teams, that Richard Slater's umpiring team can adjudicate the racing. And as you know, the umpiring is partly on the water with observers, and majority of that is the big calls are made off the water. So the priority was to get that system redesigned from scratch, which took quite some time. And then you kind of move to the television side of things, which is, as you said, you know, all the radio waves, which kind of bring the camera signals off, which was a big job. Our production partner, Circle O, who are a joint venture between Riedel and Westmore Media from Europe, did a really nice job of the engineering side of that. It's not new to have onboard cameras on yachts or microphones, but it's always, always really challenging to get those feeds in clean, not broken up. It's a super challenging environment. And we didn't have the, because of the COVID impact, we lost our warm-up regattas. Our warm-up regattas were practice time for the teams. They're also practice time for us in television. And so technically we hit the ground running in the early days of the competition. It was really, you know, take it off the design board and put it out there and commission it. And so they've done a really nice job to engineer things so well that when we turned it on, it pretty much worked as promised. And so, you know, largely the idea was, you know, I guess if you go back in time, you know, it was 2013 San Francisco, the first time that we had stadium kind of graphics came up, which gave us geography on the race course, which was a real breakthrough. And in sports, you don't get big breakthroughs every day, but that was like a breakthrough that it really caught sailing up with a lot of other kind of sports such as NFL, which made the sport more understandable or explainable. And so we were working with that technology, kind of designing elements to make sure we could bring those graphic stadium concepts to this America's Cup, which worked nice, and we put a few new touches on that graphically too, just to make things a bit more decipherable. And so, yeah, it's a big team. It's 75 people getting up each day and giving it their all, whether they're onboard camera riggers or, you know, technical engineers, and then you've got all the operational staff as well.
A lot of moving parts to that, a lot of potential for things to go wrong. From the outside, the TV coverage looked amazing, but did things go wrong? Was there a bit of flapping behind the scenes?
When you work in TV, I guess it's a bit like all the sailing and racing. Anybody who races knows that it's about how you recover when things go wrong. So, yes, certainly there were things going wrong, so to speak, all the time. And generally that's equipment, because we're pushing our equipment, you know, right to the levels of its capacity. We're stressing it all the time. The America's Cup production is a bit of a quasi-host feed. In classical terms, a host television feed would be that you just cover the racing and let all of your television rights holders bookend the racing, and they can wrap their own fronting around it, run their own features, which a broadcaster such as Rai in Italy or Sky Italia or TVNZ here in New Zealand would do. Not every broadcaster is going to commit the funds to that effort. And so we need to make a program which is seamless to viewers, so that whose viewing experience is coming directly from us and host. So we put a huge amount of effort in the build-up to the regatta, into pre-production, which is getting out there and building feature stories on as many aspects of the teams and the cup as we could, to explain the technology, to explain the race yacht, to introduce as all of the sailors to the audience, so that in between the two races each day, we'd be rolling these features in so that people would get a pretty thorough idea of what the racing is about, including the rules themselves. The idea is to across, you know, it's a long regatta. It's, you know, a marathon, not a sprint, so we had plenty of time to bring the audience along, try and teach them if they didn't know the rules of the game, so that as you go through the summer and you get to the sharp end and, you know, flags are flying, people are there with you as it's happening.
Was this the approach that was always taken? You've been involved, I think, in 4 or 5 America's Cups. If you go back to the pre-high performance days, to the lead mines, if you like, I know we covered the racing, but did we do all of this surrounding of the whole event in the way you've just described?
The approach to America's Cup that we've kind of emulated this time really first came in San Francisco. It was largely a reaction to, you know, the financial crisis of the early 2000s, which kind of led to a bit of a drop-off in budgets and television, which hadn't really recovered. So it's meant that as hosts, we've had to work harder to make sure we're engaging audiences. The thing with this America's Cup, because of the dearth of other live sports, it was a massive opportunity for sailing to step up into the limelight. You know, we recognised that that there wouldn't be much else going on, and there would be an audience there sitting for something live versus replays, you know, something they didn't know what the outcome of the competition was going to be. And so we went, geez, this is a really big opportunity for sailing. It's a massive opportunity for America's Cup internationally. We need to work super hard to put our very best foot forward for the America's Cup, for sailing. And, you know, when you watch a lot of chatter and the feeds on our social media channels, it was really encouraging to see that was the reaction we're getting. You know, people sat there having some pretty tough times dealing with COVID and all that that means, and then we're able to put this event forward, and whether people were sailing fans or America's Cup fans or not, it was something, you know, they felt like, yeah, maybe this whole thing's going to send its axis, and this is pretty cool.
Yeah, it was certainly people were setting their putting dates in their appointments in their diaries to watch, setting alarms like I did for the middle of the night, trying to cover it on my website. I want to ask you a question about the pre-event before Christmas. Was there, for you, as there was for me, and I suspect several other people, a sense of relief that these boats could actually race against each other credibly? You know, when you saw the first match begin and the boats went upwind and were actually tacking and making a proper race, did you think, oh, okay, now we've got something here?
Massively, yeah, 100%. I'm going to laugh because, you know, I was working very closely with Grant Tolton, which was a real experience. And, you know, he had that experience himself, you know, when the boats first flew and they came from concept to proof of concept. And he kind of went, phew, thank goodness for that, because, you know, it was a really bold, massive leap, the AC-75. It reminded me of the AC-72, that, you know, the giant catamarans that the guys raced in San Francisco. And, you know, the AC-75 had the same impact. Did really feel like a boat that you go, whoa, this is what the America's Cup should be about. Something when you see it, you kind of, you just can't help but keep looking at it. You know, the experience I had living here in Auckland was I would watch kind of the public experiencing the AC-75s and their training. It would stop traffic, it would stop pedestrians, you know. It's just impossible to keep doing what you're doing when those things go past. And when you really have to see them up close and personal yourself to really get what they mean. And that's the same thing with the AC-72. You know, that thing, the guys that kind of in the early years particularly, who kind of broke ground and kind of took these big boats foiling, they were really impressive sailors, particularly the helmsmen, guys that, you know, kind of grabbed the handlebars and said, right, let's go. You know, it's like nothing, you can't give those guys enough praise as to kind of getting us to where we are now.
Do you think if sailing hadn't have progressed on this very steep learning curve with the foiling and the very high performance, high speeds, do you think you would have still have been as interested in doing the role you did this time around?
Oh, yeah, love the America's Cup, born and bred to it. You know, a part of what we're doing is entertainment. And, you know, the sailors and designers, you know, they recognize that, you know, there's no going back. We can't put the smoke back in the bottle. You know, the foiling generation is here to stay. You know, the boats are going four times the wind speed. I don't know, it's not my place, but, you know, it feels that to go backwards would be a big consideration. And so, yeah, the AC-75 is a really remarkable race yacht to film. It's incredibly photogenic. And, you know, all you have to do is point a lens at it and off she was going. I think the biggest challenge we kind of face is, as we're going faster, naturally, you know, the sport is becoming more impersonal, some might claim. You know, the athletes need to be wearing helmets and visors. It becomes a lot harder to recognize who's who. It's you know, in a rugby scrum, it's pretty easy to see who's who. In the NFL, if you're a passing fan, it's quite difficult to pick up, you know, the nuances of the personalities. And that's something that we're now facing in the America's Cup, which is why all of the packaging work we do is really vital, you know, putting the team lineups up before we go racing, doing feature stories with the athletes so they get to tell us about their background and their aspirations and their dreams, and so that people can get to know them and then slowly start to connect the dots as what makes each team tick. But I think, you know, this AC-75 was a really spectacular cup, brand new class, big boats, like you say, geez, are they even going to get up and fly? And when they did, you know, here in Auckland, it was pretty spectacular for the World Series. We had really good quality racing. The form guide wasn't really kind of confirmed. You know, Team New Zealand had a capsize, which, you know, kind of stirred things up. And it was a very different feeling compared to when we were first supposed to be racing, which was at least 12 months previously. We were supposed to be up with the boats in Europe, and it was kind of deemed that we needed more lead time for them, which was the right call in retrospect. The sailors really did need time to get to grips with the AC-75s. And that, you know, I think it would have been a pretty unfair kind of start to that cup cycle versus, you know, the team's been able to put their best foot forward here in Auckland for that pre-Christmas regatta, which was quite something.
The sailors weren't the only ones who had some challenges with those boats, though. You say just point a lens at them and they're very photogenic, but you got to keep the lens steady. You got to keep it on the boat. And there's some technical challenges to all of the fantastic footage we saw from off the boat and from on the boats. And I want to just, as well as the cameras, which I'd like you to talk about a bit, talk also about the sound quality, because I was blown away by how clearly we could hear what the sailors were talking about.
Yeah, it's a good question. Sound often gets forgotten about. But, you know, when you go to TV school, the first thing they'll teach you is how important sound is. And we put a huge amount of effort into sound. One of the reasons that we were attracted to Reed Owl particularly is to work with us as our production partners. They're one of their kind of core businesses is comms and audio. In past America's Cups, to get audio off sailors, we used to put little lapel mics on, which are body worn, onto the sailor, and it would carry a transmitter, would pick that signal up and bring it back. The downside of that is you get a lot of clothing rustle on the microphone and waterproofing things. And then as the games move forward, you know, the sailors end up, they've got their own helmets on and they're having to use kind of microphone booms in order to be able to even run the boat with each other. The speed that they're going at, you know, nearly 100 k's an hour, is, you know, it's a bit like if you stand up through the sunroof at highway speeds and all the wind noises and try and talk to somebody in the driving seat, then you're not going to hear a thing, you know, or stick your head out the window. And so that's what we're dealing with. The sailors are dealing with that and we're dealing with that. So we needed some pretty innovative solutions to be able to bring the audio on board. And as you know, the way that sailors run the boats is really clinical. And what was quite extraordinary in Auckland was because it was quite a narrow race course and some of the inner harbour courses particularly quite shifty, there was some real yachting to do. You know, there were real decisions to be made. And so having clear audio was a must have. And, you know, technically the guys put a lot of work in it. They worked closely with Sennheiser. So we had four of the sailors on each boat. We could pick up four of their signals and we could hear groups of other chat, and we had another eight FX mics spotted around the boat to pick up the ambience of the yacht itself, to hear what the boat sounds like if it's been run, to hear the wind as well, which is a really important factor. And so, yeah, I think and then the team behind the scenes, our engineers, were playing with the mixers and filtering a lot every day to try to clean things up. So, yeah, there was some good yachting. There was a lot of good audio. And then the key to all that is every day with the commentators, and it's really natural at the start of the event, we had a very diverse commentary team. Stephen McIver leading as anchor, supported by Kenny Reid, Shirley Robinson, Nathan Outeridge, all stars. We couldn't believe we had the opportunity to pick up a guy such as Nathan Outeridge, who could have and should have and would have been racing one of the AC75s and have him working alongside us. You've got so much experience in the commentary booth that the inclination is to keep talking. So something we as a group talked about every day and kicked off from day one is we need to lay out and listen, let the show breathe, allow the viewers to hear the audio. And to those guys' credit, they did a great job of that, and they self-policed, particularly in the starts. If you go back and listen to it, we had a fairly good kind of set, kind of playbook where we set the teams up, get them into the box, and then to stop talking and allow the sailors to tell us the story themselves.
I thought Stephen did a particularly good job as the straight man, because as you know, and I suspect this is correct, but tell me if I'm wrong, his role is to play the role of the uneducated viewer who doesn't know anything about sailing, to put his ego to one side and ask the dumb questions so that people don't have to scratch their heads and wonder what VMG is and all of that stuff. And I thought he did a great job of it. And also I thought Kenny and Nathan did a lovely job of kind of ribbing him about that, even though they knew exactly what he was doing. So it all came over as quite natural, I thought.
Yeah, Stephen McIver is a New Zealand sportscaster, for those who don't know. He is a general sportscaster. He's really old school. He's been doing this his whole life. And Dolts was pretty determined to have a Kiwi voice in the lineup, and he respected and listened to us that we were making an international feed. So it was really important that our host TV feed wasn't packed full of Kiwi accents, which would be really wrong, because it's up to TVNZ to fly the Kiwi flag. It was up to us as hosts to have an international commentary team. So Stephen was our single Kiwi in that group, alongside kind of Shirley from the UK and Kenny Reed from the US and Nathan Altridge from Australia. And so Stephen's background kind of wasn't, you know, he admits he's not from a sailing background, not an America's Cup expert. And in some ways, we kind of saw that as a plus, you know. Dolts really enjoys Stephen's work because they're both mad, you know, motor racing fans, and it's where Stephen does a lot of his work. Why I like Stephen McIver is that I needed a guy who could keep the train on the tracks, a guy who's, when things are getting lumpy behind the scenes, can soak that up and keep things very smooth in the presentation. And so, like a lot of old-school sportscasters, he has the gift of working with open comms. That means he's running the conversation with three or four people. At the same time, he's listening in his ear to the director and taking direction from me as well, and able to process all of those incoming feeds and keep things going. And importantly, stay in the conversation. And as you say, like he, you know, Kenny and Nathan were ribbing him beautifully because they recognized that Stephen did his homework. He started from scratch. He learned a lot. And his role was to ask the questions that people at home were thinking, to find answers for those questions. And so skirting with, you know, knowing enough but not knowing too much, so you could ask innocent questions. He did a really good job in his debut on America's Cup, and it was a real pleasure to work alongside him. It was really good fun. He really enjoyed the camaraderie in the commentary booth. Our day would probably the most special part of every day for me as a producer was the hour every morning when we would get the commentary team assembled in the Portacom. We would lock the door, and with Wayne Leonard, our director, we would talk through our day. Okay, every single day we ran that discipline to go, okay, what's our theme? What's happening? Where should we be taking the story? You know, where is the beating pulse of today's story? And so Stephen really enjoyed that aspect of things because it's a slightly frat house with he and Kenny, which is always going to happen, which is good. And I think you could hear it on air that they enjoyed each other's company. And, you know, some good friendships were forged.
And I got to mention, I always forget to mention Shirley because she's such a pro at this that I always sometimes feel she doesn't need to be told. But I thought her sailing experience and her Olympic excellence just came through and was really valuable from a racing point of view, kind of away from the foils and all of that sort of technology, which Nathan filled a gap on that. You know, we were learning how these boats were going to be raced and what they could do and what they couldn't do. And I thought she did a great job of articulating that.
Yeah, I've always loved working with Shirley and kind of rubbed shoulders with her in the UK for 10 years. And, you know, when you use the word excellence, that sums Shirley Robertson up. She gets used a lot in the commentary role around the world. And it's quite difficult to find a sportscaster with her level of sailing knowledge. And as you say, double Olympic gold medalist, you know, when Shirley sets her mind to something, it gets done to the nth of its possibility. And so it was a real pleasure having Shirley work with the team and to have her eyes on the water, spotting what was happening. She could see exactly what the sailors were seeing in terms of shifts and pressures and then try to factor into that as to decisions made on the race course. And what was really important is, you know, we put people into roles, and you might have noticed we mixed those roles up in the early days to allow the commentators to experience different parts of the cup. When we got to the sharp end, we put them into very defined roles. You know, Shirley's role was very much to be on the water, to be the eyes and ears for the commentary team to kind of pick shifts as she was seeing them. And then Nathan was there largely to give us the insights that somebody who's experienced these large foiling generation of boats can do. And, you know, Kenny couldn't deliver that because that's not the era of the America's Cup that he grew up in and skipped it in. And so that was a really nice kind of supplement alongside Kenny, whose stock of knowledge about the cup and the game and the background politics and just the sheer enjoyment that Kenny has and then allows us all to feel, we have a really nice different kind of group dynamic where everybody knows what position to play. When everyone does play their position, it works beautifully. But it's really important to clearly describe those roles going in.
So we were lucky to have Nathan because, as you say, he should have probably been steering one of the boats in some way, form or other. And he has his Sail GP commitments as well. What was the feedback from him? I sense that he really enjoyed the role. I mean, if you're not actually involved in a cup team, those are the best seats in the house, aren't they?
Yeah, I worked on Nathan Aldridge for about a year, hoping, praying, I don't know, sorry, Nate, that he wouldn't end up on a cup boat. But I, you know, right up to going on air, I expected he was going to get that call where he's going to get yanked and we'd lose him. It was extraordinary luck for us to have a guy of Nathan's talent on the beach, so to speak, for a cup cycle. Extraordinary. And that was an opportunity that we couldn't pass up. Nathan, I've heard Nathan commentate before. He's a really good communicator for the sport. There are quite a few in the America's Cup. Freddie Carr is another one. Andrew Campbell, Anderson Reggio, really solid communicators. And so we tapped all those guys on the shoulder, but it was fantastic having Nathan. He kind of shared his stock of knowledge really beautifully. Largely, we wanted him to have an eye on the numbers because, you know, this was brand new territory for all of us. And we have a lot of data coming into the background for the television project, and not all of it we can use. And we needed somebody who was pretty much eyes on the inside, somebody who had lived and breathed what it is to put these campaigns together and had a really strong idea of what's going on in the background in terms of the day-to-day number crunching to, you know, improve your AC75 performance. I mean, so Nathan's job was to keep a really close eye on those numbers and try and spot those changes. And he really loved that because that's what the cup game's about, peering over the fence of the opposition and getting, you know, pretty buzzed on what their foil choices are and what you've seen in terms of how they're setting their mast up and all that stuff. So Shirley, Nathan, Kenny, they were a buzz every day with what they're spotting, bringing that to the commentary group and then kind of getting that out on air.
So that they were the visible faces, literally, of it. I guess, well, we didn't see very much of their faces, but they were the visible, audible voices of it, let's put it that way. I wanted to just talk a little bit about some of the people behind the scenes, and in particular, the people, first of all, managing the cameras that are off the boats, the helicopter cameras. I know you and I both know some of these people quite well, but it really is skilled work. And also the helicopter pilots, let's not forget the amazing job that they have to do with these boats.
Yeah, so how the America's Cup production works is we have the we run two helicopters, a high wide helicopter which runs carries augmented reality graphics, and that gives us this ladder line, the stadium effect, and then an action helicopter. We also run two TV chase boats on the water. Something to think about with these race yachts is they're going so fast that they take a heck of a lot of keeping up with on the water. And so when you're running at those kinds of speeds, you stress the boats, the television equipment, the people quite highly. And so you need to be kind of set up that you are going to have technical breakdowns occasionally. And Sod's law is that technical breakdown will always happen in an America's Cup final versus earlier on in the rounds. And so the guys who were running the helicopter equipment There was a mix of the AMI production lads out of the UK and our colleagues that we've been working with for over a decade, Matt Connor, Adam Brown, real true artists when it comes to covering sailing. Unlike a lot of other sports, probably the closest I've seen is Tour de France, where nothing's sitting still. It's a very fluid sports production to make sailing. And it can be very poetic. If you kind of tap into the rhythm and the energy, you can get some really nice sequences going. When you put a aerial cameraman of the quality of Matt Connor together with a helicopter pilot of the quality of Tony Monk from here in New Zealand, you get some really spectacular stuff. I think for a lot of the people on the water and on the hillsides watching, it was, you know, a bit of a competition as to who got their attention, the race yachts or Tony Monk in his helicopter. Tony's background was an agricultural pilot, and then, you know, the machine's pretty much a part of him. And so Tony's a colleague we've known for some years, but this is the first time we've really had, you know, several months put he and someone like Matt Connor together to show us, you know, what we can achieve. And it was a pretty interesting decision because everyone would know that, you know, drones play a big role in a lot of sailing coverage these days. Drones featured in both San Francisco and Bermuda America's Cup coverage, and we played with it here in Auckland too. The race course that we're working with, going back to a Wynmud Lured race course, was less attractive in terms of running a drone program alongside. In San Francisco and Bermuda, with reaching starts and reaching finishes, that was a natural point with which to catch up with the coverage with a drone. The boats would come around the mark and they'll straight line it, either from the start to the first mark or from the final mark to the finish. And a drone could tuck in behind and keep going. We were really enthusiastic to achieve that for this America's Cup because a drone's a very different tool to a helicopter. And so a drone, ideally, you'd kind of limp it onto the back of the race yacht and let it sit there all day, give them a nice wide shot, allow the boat to do its thing in the frame, freeing the action helicopter up to shoot very close up on detail on people and action. But the downside of running drones is, you know, in order to achieve the technical picture quality we need, you need to carry a video transmitter. And because you're carrying a video transmitter, you need more payload capacity on the drone. You end up with a bigger drone, you know, bigger battery. Suddenly, you get a drone the size of a dining table, which is a significant piece of equipment to have in the air. And it takes a team, a waterborne team of about four people to run that safely. So I guess that's something that we're excited about in terms of what's on the table in the future for America's Cups. Looking forward to when the drone technology gets to the point where the drones are small enough, nimble enough, and less threatening enough for the sailors that we can kind of have a drone attached to each boat and bring that angle to people, which would be a real breakthrough. Putting a drone team on the water meant chasing on the water, and something, you know, you would have noticed all of our craft that we use are all catamarans to keep wake down and windage down. The foiling yachts are quite susceptible to wake, particularly when it's light, and so it was kind of decided that in lieu of putting a drone out there and another rib on the water, it would be better to invest in two helicopters and fly them really, the action helicopter really dynamically, as everybody saw in the hands of Tony Monk, and then and do that. And so similarly on the water, you know, a Team New Zealand repurposed their AC-45 catamaran and turned that into a TV chase boat. We were using shot over cameras in the air and on the water, who make gyro-stabilized camera systems from New Zealand. And they work beautifully in that environment, really, really beautifully. We're thrilled. And so we've got 46 times lenses, massive lens power, two chase boats stumbling around in the hands of great drivers and really good camera operators. So, yeah, photographically, those are the guys who are doing it hard. You know, they spend their day thundering around at 40 knots, looking into a viewfinder like this, never looking up. You need to have a cast iron stomach, and it's kind of an experience base which has been forged over, you know, two decades.
Yeah, and Matt and Adam worked on a lot of ocean race campaigns, and always do amazing work. And then back in the studio, these guys are hurtling through the air and across the water. Back in the studio, it's all very calm, right? Everything's just ticks over nicely. Describe the atmosphere.
Yeah. My background is live TV, and my kind of career started in news and current affairs. And there I met a lot of the colleagues that we're working with in the America's Cup. When you're making live TV, working in studios, you kind of learn the fundamentals of keeping the show on the rails, and then into your career, you get your eyes up off the paper and onto the screens and get more comfortable with you just kind of telling the story as it's coming in. So Wayne Leonard was the director we had working with us, and he directed both in San Francisco and Bermuda. Really experienced multi-camera director, done a heap of work in golf and every sport you can think of, and has done a really nice job with AC36. And so behind the scenes, what Wayne and I are dealing with is, you know, coaching the commentary team, listening to what's happening on the race yachts. We have dedicated onboard camera operators. They are listening to their boat. They're feeding that information forward. Wayne's role is basically he's got the two helicopter feeds coming in. He's got two chase boat feeds coming in. He's got the option of four cameras from each race yacht at a time out of about 10 cameras, which was selectable, and then kind of roving crowd cameras, and then a slow motion replay team who can feed in multiple channels of different angles of things that, you know, we didn't catch live, or, you know, running feature stories and whatnot. So there's quite a lot of coordination happening behind the scenes. It's pretty old school kind of approach to sports production. A lot of news and current affairs production is down to one or two person control rooms. Something that we all love doing is these types of productions, because you're relying on teamwork. You know, the television production's not different in many ways to the sailing teams themselves. You know, it's about the same size of group, 75, 80 people, and everybody has a very specialized expert role to play, and it's about recruiting well, and then allowing those people to do their jobs, giving them the tools they need, and then allowing them, just setting them free. And I guess that's the fun bit. It's the most stressful part of the entire production. You know, you can work for 3 years, and the final 3 months you'd think are really stressful, but actually those 3 months are the best fun part, because then you get all your friends and colleagues back around you, and it's a bit like going to a rugby scrum. You go, righto, we have to, who we're trying to beat. We're trying to beat is not having a clean show. Every day our goal is to go on here and put our very best foot forward and have no mistakes and get every single of the brilliant shots that the helicopter and chase and onboard teams are working so hard to deliver up on air. You know, as we kind of talked about earlier, you know, the television miracle is that those shots are even coming to land, and a courtesy of our engineering friends, they've managed to live up to their side of the bargain. Our side of the bargain as producers is to kind of knit that story together.
And the feedback is instant these days, isn't it? Social media means that if you get it wrong, then they tell you straight away. They don't always tell you when you get it right. It's kind of a bit of a goalkeeper's job. Did you study social media much? Did you pay much attention to it, or was it better to just, yeah?
Yeah, social media, you have to keep an eye on social media. And, you know, a lot of the feedback we got was really complimentary. So thank you to those who took the time to do that. You know, some people just say thanks. It's like, that's amazing to receive that. And it was gratefully received by our team. And then, yes, we listened and we kind of discussed and reviewed carefully a lot of the more kind of critical feedback we're getting too. Something that we struggled a little bit with this first iteration of the AC75s was that some of the audio was very competitive. Some of the hydraulic noise coming off the boats was very noisy, and there was no way of getting rid of it. Some of the teams were dealing with it themselves in their own onboard comms. Something which was spoken about in the mop-up to this event. And so that can make, you know, if the aim is to make the onboard comms more decipherable against the background noise, there was nothing we could do about that, because a lot of the ambient noise is pouring through the speakers boom mics themselves. So those are things we'll work on and we're really conscious of, and part of the feedback we receive from the audiences, something we're working on as hard as we could during the event, that kind of went, well, that's as far as we can go with it. But yeah, feedback's really important, and the thing is to be open-minded about hearing it.
You said at the top of the interview that you felt like you left everything out there on the field of play, like the teams did. Is there anything, though, that's bugging you that you think, oh, God, I wish we could have got that, I wish we could have pulled that off, I wish we could have done that?
The drone angle was something which was frustrating. I'm really looking forward to bringing that to audiences where we can have a drone pretty much in a follow me mode for the race yachts, and something, you know, which will tuck us in nice and close. Because, you know, like the commentary where the temptation is to talk all the time, when you are directing, you know, the camera cut to, you know, from all the angles you have available in the gallery, you're choosing angles to show to a viewer and go, okay, to make sense of the story and show them extraordinary angles. And so it was frustrating that we couldn't bring that drone shot, because actually it'll be a nice close camera. You're on a wide-angle lens. You can allow, sometimes take a jibe or a tap, allow it all to happen in frame, and the viewer will just see everything they need to because you're so close. When we get that angle into that intimate angle into this coverage, it'll be, I think it'll be deemed a real breakthrough. And we're going to be really close. You know, hopefully by the time we do AC37, then, you know, hopefully that technology will be in place so that we can bring that to the event.
So that's for next time. And just a final question for you. It's a bit of an obvious one, I guess. Given the success, and we've talked about this away from podcasts and formal interviews, Leon, given the success of Formula One's Drive to Survive, is there a case for something similar with the America's Cup teams that covers the build-up of all of these teams and really gets us in behind the scenes? Because I think then we can get the public really engaged with this sport.
That's a really interesting question, and it appears on the feedback that we're constructing at the moment. Clearly, it's something which has come up for America's came up in the build-up to this America's Cup. You know, we talked about Grant Dalton. As you know, Grant Dalton's a massive motor racing fan. He would have digested and redigested every minute of the Netflix series Drive to Survive on Formula One. And I watch a lot of that sports television myself, and there's lots of different franchises of it. The America's Cup is an extraordinary story behind the scenes. The challenge is for the teams is to figure out, okay, how much of that story can you show? You know, the part of winning the cup is, you know, the war is as much off the water as it is on, and it is quite spectacular, you know, what goes on. And it'll be amazing to bring that side of the story to viewers. Now, clearly you can't delve into the design secrets. That would have to be off limits, like it is in Drive to Survive. But there's still plenty of characters, and I think what those shows demonstrate is the pressure that is on the teams to succeed, to improve every single day. Massive, massive pressure. We all see the surface level, people like Terry Hutchinson stepping up to, you know, front for his team when things have gone awfully, awfully wrong. And, you know, those are massive moments in campaigns, but there are also massive moments frequently behind the scenes too. And so, like, I'm a real proponent of bringing that kind of storytelling to the America's Cup. I think it's low-hanging fruit. There are risks and rewards for the teams to weigh up. The teams this time, as they often do, make their own behind-the-scenes documentaries, and hopefully those will come out soon. I think that really they'll be better programs if they are combined, and you can move between and see the cause and effect of you know, a good day in the water or a bad day on a campaign.
It needs to be independent as well, though, doesn't it? Because otherwise it'll inevitably come out as PR and not as an authentic chronicle of what actually happened. But I take your point. We'll have to wait and see. feed it into the debrief if you wouldn't mind. That would be much appreciated. I think we've got enough characters in sailing that we can certainly match Formula One. And Formula One, when I watch Drive to Survive, it's got nothing to do with the cars. I'm the least petrol head person you'll ever meet, but I love the personalities. I love the drama they create and the tension and the, you know, just the personal battles between the drivers and the team managers. It's just amazing. And we've got all of that, I think, in the Cup.
Yeah, I agree. I think the what's extraordinary about Drive to Survive, and as you say, the Cup has it all, is if you're not a Formula One fan, you watch that series and you are a Formula One fan, and you can name every driver and who they're driving for and what seat they move from and what seat they might move towards. And I've had those conversations in coffee shops with people who would never paid any attention to it. It's extraordinary cut through. And that essentially what they've done is bring Formula One to a brand new audience, something that the America's Cup could do too. But I think largely what it demonstrates is how big the role is for the team managers, how massive their jobs are, how much responsibility they carry, and just some insights as to that side of the game.
So now for you, Leon, I know you're doing the wrap-up from 36, AC 36. When do you start thinking about AC 37, or have you already?
Always thinking about AC 37. Start to work on it already in terms of concepts, you know, in terms of video standards, whether we should be, you know, pushing for HDR or 4K productions and the impacts of that kind of thing. And so, yeah, it's just keeping an eye on technology shifts and talking to people about the future. Right now, it's just a matter of biding our time while the New Zealand government takes its opportunity to consider whether it wants to take up hosting AC 37 again. So it's an opportunity to step back and breathe and really consider how we went. I guess, in summary, you know, something I learned from visiting some Australian colleagues who put together the Supercar Series and one of the best motor racing events down in New Zealand, which is like our Australasia's NASCAR, is Bathurst. Something a colleague producer pointed out to me when I went to visit him was, I asked him, you know, what provides your continuity? Where does the standards come from? How do you keep getting better? And he said, that's a really simple answer. He just pointed to a person who was vision switching and a person in the sound booth and said, that woman there, she's been working on the supercars for 25 years. That guy there, he's been working on it for 20 years. This guy here, he's new. He's only done 10 years. It doesn't mean that there's not room for new entrants, but I think probably the joy for me in this last campaign in television terms was putting the band back together, so to speak, introducing some new blood. And the colleagues that I have the privilege of working alongside have a huge amount of experience. It's about tapping into that experience and kind of sitting alongside them and getting involved in the ride, and then everybody throwing their ideas and how we can make this better and better. The whole thing, you know, talking to Ian Taylor from ARL, you know, all the tools that his company bring to sailing the sport, with the graphic stuff that you see in Major League Baseball and golf that shows ball flight and putting lines, all that stuff. It's not about the graphics. It's about how you unlock the stories and make a complex sport more understandable. So that's what we'll continue to challenge ourselves with, is what can we do different next time? You know, what feedback are we getting? What do people struggle to understand about sailing, and how can we solve that?
That's exciting. It's great to hear. And it's great to hear such enthusiasm in your voice after a long, old campaign with 36. I hope you do get some proper downtime at some point soon. And but just for now, thanks so much for the interview today. It's been really interesting and really insightful, and I'm sure people will enjoy it. So Leon, thanks a million.
You're very welcome, and thanks for the interest.
That's it for this edition of the Yacht Racing Podcast Extra. My sincere thanks to Leon Sefton for giving up his time to speak to me, and thanks also to all of you for listening around the world. I will be back soon with another great interview guest, but until then, I'll just say Bye for now.